Imagine a world where everyone can legally experience the benefits of CBD, hemp, and medical marijuana. Learn about the legal benefits of licensing, distribution, health benefits, and important issues regarding these products. You are now tuned in to the Himes Hemp's Education Podcast, hosted by Chris Ford.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Himes Hemp Education Podcast, where I am your host, Chris Ford. And what we're going to be talking about is educating people on the topics of CBD, hemp, and medical marijuana, medical marijuana in this industry, guys. So if you enjoy our podcast, if you've been watching certain episodes, we want you to support us, right? The best way to support us is follow us on Spotify, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Breaker. So go and like our episodes and comment on them. If you have a question about what we're talking about, definitely leave it in the section where you can leave your comments or questions and we'll get back to you. So this is a way that you can find us easier. Our ratings will skyrocket, and it's a way that if you're interested in learning more about CBD and hemp, you know, of course, the company that I'm promoting, Hempology Wellness Products, guys, we have CBD honey sticks, the hemp sticks. We also have lollipops, right? So have you ever been in a situation where you was going through road rage and, you know, you're frustrated, you have high anxiety, somebody just cut you off, so you are really pissed off, right? So what do, right? Before you actually make a decision to get into more engagement with this person that may be frustrated and upset as well, pop one of these in your mouth, right? You pop one of these in your mouth, I'm telling you, it will help you to calm down. It will take your anxiety down. You won't be as frustrated and upset as you was, because that's what it's about. It's about resetting your mood, resetting your mood of what may get you in trouble, you know, because you never know. So with that being said, I have a guest today, right? My guest is Jamal Rose. Jamal Rose. So Jamal, what's going on? How you doing, man? It's been a while.
Not much. I'm good. How about yourself?
Hey, I'm doing great. So, yeah, so Jamal, it's been a minute since we actually talked, and, you know, I'm looking forward to this actual conversation here, because we've been trying to get this going for, wow, probably a couple of weeks, a couple of months. So I'm excited that you decided to, you know, give us a chance and to have this conversation, to have this interview. It's a lot of things about CBD and hemp that a lot of people don't understand. A lot of people haven't maybe did enough research, or they're just scared because of what they think is a scheduled drug, and because in certain states it may not be legal in their state, so they're even scared to inquire about it. So we're going to educate people a little bit about CBD and hemp, and then we're going to go into hearing your story, your remarkable story of how you overcame triumph, how you overcame as a young child, trying to find their way, maybe getting into a little bit of trouble, and just being able to overcome your situation. So, have you ever tried CBD before, or maybe hemp? And if you have, what was your experience in that?
Yes. Well, I tried the CBD, the cream. I actually went to a CBD seminar, and that's how you introduced me to it a long time ago.
Okay.
But like other people, you hear it and you move on, because you're just something you're not familiar with. And then I went to a seminar, a free seminar about it, and it told me the same things you were telling me, basically.
Okay.
But I guess how we are, we don't hear it from the people who are closest to us.
True.
Outside that, tell us, and we'll listen a little more.
Right.
So hearing about it, it made me interested in it. So I was going through something. I'm a truck driver. I drive trucks.
Okay.
And in driving trucks, my knees were starting to, starting to have an effect on my knees.
Okay.
And I tried a lot of things. I tried the little copper sleeve and everything, and that worked for a second, you know. But like I said, it worked for a second. But then I tried some CBD cream.
Okay.
And how I did it was I walked by a kiosk in the Florida Mall.
All right.
And the lady told me, she called me over there and tried to introduce me to CBD. But I had already, and I had just came from the seminar maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago. So I was like, okay, this is what they were talking about. So she told me to try it. And I told her, at the time I had a wrist injury too. So she told me try it. And I was like, ah. So she said, try it, walk around the mall, and put it on your wrist, walk around the mall, and if it works, come back and buy. If it don't work, don't come back.
Hmm. Okay.
I actually did it. I put it on my wrist, and I went to shopping, and I really didn't pay mind to it until I was leaving the mall, and I seen the kiosk, and I flexed my wrist, and I was like, whoa. And I laughed because the lady, she caught me like flexing my wrist, and she said, did it work? I said, yes, it did. And I bought it. So when I got home and my next day going to work, I put some on my knees.
Okay.
And when I tell you, for that night, didn't have no pain. And I didn't have no pain, and I'm talking about this was something I was really going through it with.
Okay.
And with that, I rubbed it on that night. So, of course, I'm going to do it. The next few days, I'm going to do it every day. And I did it every day. And then the days I missed, I really didn't even notice I missed them because the pain had actually gone away.
Mm.
And I have a coworker that was the same thing. He was going through, he had injured his elbow. And I wasn't out advertising CBD.
Right.
But he was just, we was having a conversation, and he told me, he said, man, my elbow is messed up and this and that. And so I told him, I said, I got something for you. I put it in another jar for him, bought it to him, and just said, put it on your elbow, see if it works. He said that in his mind, he said the same thing. Oh man, I ain't. But he did it. That next morning, I didn't see him for a couple of days because I went out working.
Okay.
And our schedules. So the next time I seen him, maybe 2 or 3 days, he handed me a whole bottle of CBD, the one Al Harrington, the basketball player, promotes.
Okay.
He handed me that, and I'm like, what is this? He's like, man, that stuff, my wife done Amazoned it, and she done bought it. She done bought me some, so I just bought you one of the ones she bought. And he was like, man, that stuff worked and this and that. So, and I also, I gave some of the cream to my mother.
Okay.
And it worked for her knees and her arthritis and stuff.
Okay.
It worked for her. So the ones I have actually done was the cream.
Okay.
You know, and I mean, everybody I give it to, swear by it now.
Wow. You know. That's an amazing testimony there. So do you feel like because you had that type of response to the CBD, would that be something that you would recommend to someone else?
Absolutely.
Like if you knew that they were in pain and
absolutely
something that you know, would give them relief?
Absolutely. And I'm not just saying that because I'm on here. I'm actually somebody who the CBD actually worked for.
Okay.
You know.
Okay.
And I know a lot of people who have, you know, you can have conversations with people, and the first thing they say is, most people be like, oh yeah, I heard of it, I see it in stores, but I don't pay it no mind.
Right.
And but I also know a lot of people who swear by it. Also, once they use it, they swear by it. It's just a matter of getting a person to use it. And that lady at that kiosk, she had that was a good strategy, because when people are going shopping, they're gonna walk around for a minute. She caught me going in.
Right.
So I actually got a chance to feel how fast it worked.
Okay.
Within that time.
Okay. Well, awesome. Because that's the thing. We have to start educating people more on CBD hemp, because it's the fact of the question that they don't understand it. They don't know exactly what it is. They're hearing stories about it, and they're actually seeing it in stores such as Walmart, Walgreens. They're actually seeing it in the gas stations, 7-Eleven, the mobile gas stations. So they're seeing it everywhere, but they're still uneducated, as well as I would say some of your legislators and your politicians, to allow at least hemp in most states, or all the states really, to become legal. You know, have it as a scheduled drug, but don't have it where if you catch people with medical marijuana or some hemp on them and say that, oh, they're out here selling it, or they're gonna do something bad because they are using it. Don't put that stigma on people. Realize that this is going to actually help law enforcement. This is going to actually help the laws, where people can actually say, hey, you know, we want to change this law because we feel that it's incriminating us. We feel that it's not right for this type of community or the people that believe a certain way in this community. So we have a right, and we want to have you guys revisit these laws and to change them, because this CBD or this hemp or medical marijuana is actually helping us. We're not having to call the police as many times. Why? Because our anxiety is down, our fear is down. We're able to, you know, overcome a lot of these accidents that we've had. Or if you know, we have children that's been in the military, and they, you know, have situations where they come home and they have high anxiety, they have mental issues, they have mood disorders, and this hemp and medical marijuana actually relieves them of that pain, of that turmoil, of everything that they've been through during a time of war or during a time of being in another country. So this is actually going to help us. It's not going to hurt us. It's not like alcohol will hurt you. It's not like cocaine or crack that may hurt you, right? This is a holistic approach that will actually help you. And that's what people don't understand. And because politicians are not being able to get in on it, as far as the millions and billions of dollars that are being made because of the CBD and hemp industry, they're trying to find a way how they can compensate. They're trying to find a way how they can tax it. And I think that's the reason that they're slowing up a lot of the progress of passing these laws.
Yes.
So what do you think about that?
Yes, yeah, it's a big money grab, and it's a lot of big farmers behind a lot of stopping the progress of this, because they haven't found a way to get their hands in it.
Mm.
You know, but we gotta just, I just feel we just gotta let the product work for itself. We gotta get it, we gotta push it out, find a way to push it out there. But with the politicians, after a while, you know, truth don't need a crutch.
Absolutely.
See, they need a crutch with the lies that they're telling, but truth don't need a crutch.
Absolutely.
Like I said, the lady told me, just rub it on my wrist, and if you want it, if it works, come back.
Right.
So she didn't have to con me into or charge me $1 million and tell me it's gonna work. She put it on me. I walked the mall. I came back. I checked, I was like, wow, and I bought it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if we just, like I said, finding a way to get to educate, but while you're educating, you have to You have to kill the myths with medicine, and because they'll let pro athletes, what's that, the painkillers that that everybody's getting hooked on, people are getting hooked on.
I can't think
opioids. But they'll let pro athletes use this, but give them a dirty urine for having marijuana. You gotta ask yourself why.
Right.
You gotta, because this cause these opioids and all that stuff, in the long run, they cause liver damage. They're addictive, all kind of stuff.
Right.
And cause all kind of complications. But here it is, hemp, CBD, and this stuff. There's no, it's not gonna kill you.
No, absolutely.
It's not gonna, you know, you could go more into how the effects it has medically, but they are none.
Right.
Or they're little, if any. I don't know. That's not my area of expertise. that's your area. But
it has a calming effect, and two, when you get into the science and the molecular structure of breaking down, you know, what it's about. If you look here on this shirt, on this Himes Hemp Education Podcast shirt, right? You see the molecular structure of the cannabis,
yeah.
Right? That's the molecular structure and the compound agent of it. It has how many parts? Six, right? It's a hexagon.
Mm-hmm.
Hexagons, if you look at it, it's the same shape of a honeybee cone, of a honeycomb of the bee, how the bee actually swirls and makes the honey, right? And then they actually build their honeycomb, hide out their honeycomb, right? It has the shape of a hexagon as well.
Yeah.
So when you look at what is that made of, we're talking about carbon, because you have six protons, six neutrons, and six electrons. When you break all of that down, it resorts back into melanin. So a lot of people say, okay, what is melanin? Melanin is intelligence. Melanin is the beginning of all things. It's the original blackness, it's the original darkness that everything came out of. So when you look at CBD, hemp, medical marijuana, and you look at the molecular structure of the compound of the cannabis plant, one is natural, two, it comes from the earth, three, before you actually extract it from the earth in plant form and people start to cut it up or do whatever they do, then you alter the molecular structure of the compound and what its original use is. So you can actually take the cannabis plant and you can actually seep it in water. And once you seep it in water, you can actually make a tea from it. So it doesn't give you that psychoactive feeling that makes you high. It actually is a holistic agent that whenever you drink it, it goes and heal whatever is ailing in your body. Someone that may have cancer, someone that may have anxiety, any stress factors, anything that's going on in your body, it actually brings a calming effect and a healing effect to it. I don't want to, because of what Big Pharma does is they say that, you know, you can't use healing or this and that when you say CBD, hemp, medical marijuana. Why? Because they have coined those terms. They have made those terms. They have got those terms and those names to a point where you can't use them with healing, or you can't use it with so on and so forth. So you have to say that it helps you in this situation, or it helps aid you in that situation. So it's all about, like you said, a big money grab.
Yeah. I got a question for you.
Sure.
The CBD and the medical marijuana, in this seminar I went to, I don't remember which one they said, but they said that one was the female plant and the other was the male plant.
Right.
Could you
expound a little bit?
Yeah, just a, I mean,
Yeah, so when you're dealing with the cannabis plant, right? The cannabis plant, like on a left-hand side, on the left-hand side, you have your marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
On the right-hand side, you have your, let's just say, hemp.
Right.
Right? So you have a, like a positive and negative of an original element.
Right.
Right? Or a cousin. Let's just say a cousin. So you may have one cousin that is active, very hyper. And then you have one cousin on the other side of the spectrum that is very calm and cool, collective. So that's how I like to look at the cannabis plant. When you have your two sides of your marijuana that comes from the cannabis plant, and then you have your hemp or your CBD that actually comes from, you know, the cannabis plant. You have one side that's going to give you, make you hallucinate,
mm-hmm.
right? And then you have the other side that's going to give you that calming effect, that's going to give you that, that helping agent, quote unquote, healing agent, that's going to supplement anything that's going wrong in your body. Because one thing that we may or may not know about is you have a cannabinoid system within your body, just like you have a circulatory system, just like you have a digestive system. You have a cannabinoid system in your body, right? So everything actually goes in full circle, right? So from the hemp, you got the non-psychoactive side, which has, is lower in THC, 0.3 or less than 0.3. And then you also have, you know, how it grows up to 4 meters tall, is growing in many different countries, 120 growth cycle. From hemp, remember before you had the, the industry of alcohol, mm-hmm. where the prohibition, where they actually used to traffic alcohol from city to city or state to state, and they were worried about the cops busting them because they were taking alcohol from one state to another, right?
Yeah.
So before that prohibition, before that industry came along, you had hemp, which is, you know, the industry that people forgot about, where they used to make clothes, they used to make body creams, they used to make ropes, they used to make so many different things from hemp. And then the other side, where it's the psychoactive side, you know, you got, is high in THC, mm-hmm. 5 to 35%, right? And so that's the part that actually gives you that hallucinative feeling, as well as medical uses as well from the medical marijuana. And it also has a 90-day growth cycle. So within 90 days, you can have a full marijuana plant versus the hemp, which is 120 days.
Right.
Right. And so with, of course, with marijuana, it's illegal in most of your countries. And the marijuana plant actually grows up to 2 meters,
mm-hmm.
and versus the 4 meters that the hemp plant gives you. So those are some different differences within the cannabis plant, the hemp, medical marijuana. So it's about really it's about us educating ourselves.
Okay.
It's about us educating ourselves and what we want to know, what we need to learn, so that, you know, we can move forward. Because it seems like every other country is moving forward. Mm-hmm. It seems like Canada is moving forward. It seems like the UK is moving forward. So what's holding the US back? What's holding the US back?
I mean, I can't answer that, but I could give you my opinion. My opinion on what's holding the US back is, like what we said earlier, money. U.S. sickness is a big business.
It is.
And
the medical industry in itself.
The pharmaceutical industry is a big industry. And that's where all these laws and all this, the laws that are made and pushed and who are backed, drug laws are backed by Big Pharma.
Okay.
You know, so to me, my opinion, the reason the U.S. is the last, and Big Pharma is everywhere. It's not just the U.S.
Absolutely.
Big Pharma is everywhere. But maybe Big Pharma got their hands, or maybe they can control it more in other countries. But it's hard to control it in the U.S. So rather than try to put it out here and control it, we'll try to just keep it, stop it, and don't educate people on it. And that's why they have all these restrictions. They don't want you to educate people on it.
Right.
Because if you educate people on it, because it cures a lot.
Right.
You know, it cures a lot of things. But they don't want you to use these words. They can't stop me from saying it.
Right.
But they can stop me from saying it with that, with, you know, because you're backing a company and everything.
Right.
But, I mean, there's people who have come up missing and everything dealing with this Big Pharma.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. So, Jamal, man, we've heard your take on CBD, hemp, and medical marijuana, as well as, you know, getting some advice from me. Man, I would love to learn, or I would love for you to share more about who you are and what's your story and the reason why you're here, you know, because I've heard your story. We've talked and I think you have an amazing story. So I know that you grew up in Brownsville, Brooklyn. So shout out to the BK, shout out to Brownsville,
okay.
Right? So I'm aware that you grew up in the same area that Mike Tyson grew up in, right? So, you know, Mike Tyson, he's a big advocate of medical marijuana, CBD. So what was it like growing up in the same neighborhood as Mike Tyson?
Well, I mean, growing up in Brownsville, it's, now that you look back on it, when you're growing up somewhere, you see things as normal.
Mm.
You know, I didn't realize I was growing up. I understood it now, but I didn't understand that I was growing up in one of the toughest neighborhoods in Brooklyn. It was just a way of life for us.
Okay.
You know, and so you grow up, watching your back, and you grow up just a certain way. It's like, my friend Vernon Birch, he's a musician.
All right.
And he was teaching me about the music industry. And he said, in the music industry, you got two people. You got the raper and the rapee.
Mm.
He said, he's not going to teach you how to be the raper, but he's going to teach you how not to be the rapee.
Mm.
In order for him to do that, you have to understand the raper. Well, growing up in Brownsville, right?
Okay.
It's either you're the victim, or you're the one taken, you know. Or, you know, so I mean, basically,
the victim or the victor.
Or the victor, basically. So growing up in Brownsville, this is the mindset that you have, and I think I'm just, you know, I grew up in Brownsville, but I know this is world in every hood in America.
Okay.
Basically, but I'm talking about my hood, and so. And you're going to go through things, you know, like Mike Tyson, what made him, if you listen to his story, what made him get into boxing was somebody took something from him.
Mm.
Well, that's a normal occurrence in Brownsville. Somebody going to try you.
Right.
You know, and it's going to happen. If it don't, I don't know what part of Brownsville you grew up in.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? If you don't go through fighting, I guess that's why so many fighters come out of Brownsville. You got not only Mike Tyson, this is one neighborhood.
Right.
You got Mike Tyson, Reddick Bowe, Zab Judah, Eddie Gregory, which changed his name to Eddie Mustafa Muhammad.
Okay.
Shannon Briggs. These are just the champions.
All right.
You know, so, I mean, fighting everybody. I'm not going to say everybody from Brownsville could fight, but that's natural. That's right. A natural. And you growing up in these environments, like I said, in the mindset is just, I don't want to say culture. Yeah, the Brownsville culture is, you got to be, you know, when you go outside, you got to be bad, because if not, somebody going to take advantage of you.
Right.
You know, and it's a shame that the kids, you know, this is how kids got to grow up. But when you're growing up in it, you don't understand what you don't even understand a lot of the things that you're going through until you become an adult and get a chance to look back on your life and be like, wow, those things really had an effect on my life.
Right.
Like, I didn't have the role models I had. I had my brothers. I had two older brothers who lived in my house.
Right.
But, you know, before my teenage years, they were already in the military.
Mm.
So, you know, growing up, and they didn't have a role model. They were living their life. They, you know, so they didn't have time to, they were role models in their own sense, but they didn't have time to be a role model to a young boy. They wasn't fathers.
Right.
And that's what's in our neighborhoods. There's no connection. I understand these young guys, and it just got worse over the years. But I was one of them. There's no connection to nothing.
Hmm.
You know why? Because the old heads are not there. Even if they're there, it's not enough.
Okay.
You know, it's just not enough. And, you know, and part of me, a big part of me, feel it because I've been through it. But growing up, I'm thinking certain things, you go outside, you see certain things you just see as the norm.
Okay.
Selling drugs. I come outside, I see people. I don't see it on the news. I see people selling drugs sometimes in my hallway, sometimes in the lobby, in front of your building. You see this.
Mm.
So this becomes every day. And this is because they don't sell drugs. Drugs is like a store.
Right.
They're waiting for customers.
Right.
So you don't see it sometime, you see it all the time.
Right.
So it's not even wrong to you.
Mm.
Because in your mind, when you come out, these guys are selling drugs. These same guys that sell drugs, they're the ones getting into the fancy cars and all this.
Right.
And only time, so we connect that to success.
Right.
Young minds, you got to remember, this is how young minds are molded. We connect that to success.
Okay.
We see these guys walking to their BMW or Benzes or whatever, Cadillac, whatever, luxury cars.
Right.
And we like, wow.
How can I get that?
You know, but we don't see the doctors, the black doctors.
Right.
We don't see us walking to our luxury cars and stuff like that. That's not what we see.
Right.
Even the ownership, you know, growing up in Brownsville. Now there's a lot of black stores and stuff like that. But when growing up in Brownsville, we seen the Chinese people, the Arabic people. We seen everybody but us.
Mm.
And they'll say, oh, we're people of color just like you. But you're in my neighborhood. I can't open up in your neighborhood.
Exactly.
So, but going back, these things have an effect. So this is who my role models became, was these guys getting in these cars.
Mm.
And some of the guys had sense enough to say, hey Jim, go get me something from the store and hand you a $20 bill. Back in the days, a 20 was 100 right now.
Right.
Hand you a $20 bill or go get a bag of chips and something, and you go to hand them a change back, like, keep it. Now I definitely want to be, this is who I want to be.
Like, how do I get more of those 20s?
How do I get more of those 20s? And this is what these kids are going through, you know, and my situation was different. I was raised in the church. I had to be two people.
Right.
Most people do, but I had to really be two people. I was raised in the church, right? So my mother had us in church Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday. And y'all don't know the fights I went through and the struggles I went through. Everybody, I'm the only one in my building going to church.
Going to church.
Man, y'all don't know the struggles I went through. So I had to be a little extra. You know what I'm saying? But I was the only one in church. Even the church, in the churches, who's in that? That's the only ones, other ones you see getting in these cars and all that, were the pastors.
Right.
So, so I, basically, I had to live two lives. Church life with my mother, but as soon as I step out the door, I still got to deal with watching the drug dealers and this and that and this and that. Mm. And watching the people. So my peers had a bigger influence on me than the church did.
Right.
And it's not the churches. I won't blame it on the churches. The church I went to. I won't blame it on the church I went to.
Okay.
And but this is what's happening. Your environment is what you do every day.
Right.
And when I go down, even when we were innocent to it, we knew what was going on. When we were going outside playing basketball and football and all this, because out in front of the yard, we knew what was going on, but we was innocent. We was innocent to it at that time, even though we knew, you know. But we knew we're natural hustlers,
right?
You know. So we knew when that dude wanted something from the store. Yo, you need something from the store? Yeah,
that was or a
you
come
need,
up.
Right. Or you need your car cleaned or whatever. Right. Whatever. But that's some of us. Some of us wanted to be him. We had natural hustles like packing bags.
Right.
Right. We had a bunch of stores across the street and anybody from Brownsville know we had the Big R and you go or Jetro and you go pack bags I lived in what you call Tilden Projects, so you know you find all kind of. I had a hustle. The Spanish guys used to scrape ices and make ices. Mm. That was one of my hustles.
Yeah.
At like 10, 11 years old, so when I seen this dude, I was a natural hustler.
Right.
Still am, but when I seen this dude selling drugs every day, getting in his car, and I added 1 + 1. Two to me was what he was doing.
Right.
You know,
it wasn't scraping the ices.
No.
You can make pennies on the dollar with
I
that.
I made a lot of money scraping ices because me and my friends used to push the cart up the Pickin Avenue. Mm. Right? My mother used to be like, don't go up from outside the building. But we used to sneak it up. When she moved, we used to sneak it up. And we used to make a lot of money. A block of ice like this big. Mm. Push the cart up to Pickin Avenue if it's a good time.
Right.
That block of ice be like this when we come back. Now this big block of ice in back of the building, it might take 5 days to get that thing down like that.
Right.
We'll get it down in a few minutes. So hustling became natural.
Okay.
You know, making 1, 2 became natural. But finding different ways to hustle didn't, because now with the smaller stores, they're not putting back. Well, I would. They're not putting back in the communities.
Right.
They care less about the communities. Okay. To be honest with you, some of them.
Right.
Most of them, I'm gonna say. So, there's no way to do it there. Back in the days, McDonald's and all that was a young person's job.
Right.
Which now it ain't. So, but basically, this was my attraction to the game. Mm. I didn't know it. Mm. Going outside to play baseball in front of the building, you see transactions go on. At a young age, you know to turn your back because it ain't your business.
Right.
At a young age.
Right.
But you know what's going on.
Right.
So I'm just giving you a history of where this came. And as far as Mike Tyson, right, growing up in the neighborhood, when Mike Tyson became champ,
right,
I was in high school when he became champ, and he used to hang out with a dude in my building. Well, I ain't gonna say his name, but a big drug dealer in my building.
Okay,
dude, I learned from just watching though.
Right.
But anyway, Mike Tyson used to come in the building with him. Mm. So, like the first few times seeing him, you starstruck. It ain't like now you got your camera and you can get pictures.
Right.
Because, I mean, he used to come, he used to talk to us, and you know, so it was
to be
like,
so natural and normal. Right.
And as I got older, a lot of dudes I was around, well, matter of fact, one guy, me and him were real tight. We hustled together,
okay, basically.
This was Mike Tyson's right-hand man.
Right.
So, I mean, it was times we was around, and I got some funny, like... Okay, I'm gonna give you a one. We in the diner, right? But you know, I'm doing wrong, so I'm dirty.
Right.
And Mike Tyson, he had just got knocked out by Buster Douglas. Mm. So he come in with these big shades, and he come and he run up on my partner, Uwe. He run up on my partner,
right,
acting like he gonna punch him. But I was like, whoa, who's this? And I look, when he took the glasses off, it's Mike Tyson. Now I'm even though I'm a little old, I'm still starstruck. I'm human, okay, oh, that's Mike. And he said, yeah, come on, y'all don't, you know, let's go out to breakfast. Well, we was at a breakfast spot. He gonna say, come on, let's go out to breakfast.
Right.
And I was, like I said, I was dirty, so I told him, I said, nah, I'm gonna go my way. But you know, I mean, in the neighborhood, you always know when Mike is at a dice game.
Okay.
Because it's a big crowd.
Mm.
You know
what I'm saying? Was he good at it?
No, but his money was long. So when your money long, if my money can't compete with your money,
right,
you could stand a little. Dice is a game of luck. I mean, CeeLo. Right. We play CeeLo. Craps you can't is more skill because it's two dice, but CeeLo is more luck because it's three dice.
Yeah.
So how long can I stand for him to be unlucky? So if he's lucky 10 times in a row, that's my money. That's all my money.
Yeah.
He could be unlucky 40 times in a row and still have money for more. One time we in the club, right? And God bless it, he's dead now. But God bless the dead, my man Inf, he sent Mike back where Mike had to go leave the club,
go get some more money
and come back. And all of us got paid off of Mike. We side betting. I'm side betting, getting a couple thousand.
Right.
But I mean, you would have thought, I mean, if you let these TV, I think when Mike was in these places, he was in his natural element.
Right.
So he didn't have to act.
Okay.
He was who he was. So he lost. He just left, came back, got some more money. But it's stuff like that. So me being around him was other people. Me being around other people who knew him,
okay,
or being and just in the same place at the same time,
okay.
But as far as Brownsville, you got to hear his story, because when I heard his story of Brownsville, now everybody's story is different. Same neighborhood's a different story. I was protected in my house.
Okay.
My mother, my brothers, my sister. She was like, that's like having two mothers. Anybody that knows, that's your wife, so you know. But I was protected. But when I'm hearing their stories, like Shannon Briggs, his mother was a drug addict.
Okay.
I think Mike Tyson said his mother was a. I don't want to misquote him. I think he was saying his mother was a prostitute or whatever.
Right.
A drug addict too, though. I mean, a drug addict. But anyway, they lost their mothers at young ages.
Mm.
You know, and what we don't realize, when you lose your mother, right, at a young age,
right, that destroys you.
You lose God,
right.
And let me tell you what I'm talking about.
Okay.
And people disagree. I don't care if you disagree though, but kids understand. Kids only know about God what they're taught.
Right.
So to a kid hurt himself, what's the first thing he say?
And calling out to mama. You're looking for mama.
Kid, that's it. That's his first love, his first nurturer, whatever. Right. So imagine losing that before you even understand what God is.
Mm.
So, you know, their struggle was different than my struggle in the same neighborhood.
Right.
I had friends. I had a friend, God bless the dead, I born. But, we used to go, I mean, his mother was a dope fiend.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, it was times that, I mean, his mother, he had to search for meals.
Right.
You know, watching dudes come in and out of his house. You know what they doing with your mother. He knew. I remember one time he cried. We like 9 and 10 years old.
Mm.
You know, could you imagine? He lived with that. He was outside his we go to his house, he outside his door crying, like, yo, what's wrong? My mother in there, she won't answer the door. She didn't answer the door because she had a man in there, you know.
Wow.
But so, I mean, a lot of things that happen in other households in the same building.
Right.
Some people's, especially the crack era, some people's mothers was crackheads, had people selling crack out their house.
Right.
So, I mean, this is the hand some people are dealt.
Okay.
So, you know, I mean, but and growing up in Brownsville, it was interesting. But like I said, it was just a way of life. We were normal kids, but we were dealt a certain hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't even, you know what? I think that's why I got so much time.
Mm. So you actually did time for you doing whatever you were doing in the drug game.
Yes, I'm a natural hustler, and I followed what I saw as an opportunity, and that's what I seen it as an opportunity.
Okay.
Some people actually, that's all they had, all they knew, and all they had to do. I wasn't that person.
Mm-hmm.
Even, like I said, my mother was in the church.
Right.
So I had a job in high school. I had a job in the church as security guard, just like this building we in.
Right.
And on Sundays, I would guard the cars.
Okay.
And this is in high school.
Right.
And on other days, on other days, I would just make sure nobody break into the property.
Right.
Right. I didn't realize what that was. He didn't need that. But right. I didn't realize that me, Mark, and Mike.
Right.
I didn't realize what that was until I got older.
Right.
That was his way of keeping us off the street.
Mm.
So he paid us to be there to keep us. He didn't need that. He could have got real security.
Right.
And he might have been paying us, what, $120 a week or something like that.
Right. But he saw some kids that needed help.
Right.
And he wanted that to be a place of refuge and to teach you guys the game of, hey, this could actually be a business if you keep yourself clean. If you, you know, stick close to me, I'll show you some more things.
Yes. And let me tell you the people with that past. Let me tell you the people who I played basketball with, the Winans.
Okay.
He had all these big church people.
Right.
Or performers, whatever. Matter of fact, at his funeral, I think T.D. Jakes spoke at his funeral. He was a mega church, but he was a small church when my mother was going there.
Okay.
And he grew up, he blew up, he had schools, everything. He was very influential, but we always had access to him.
Mm.
But I didn't know how to take advantage of that.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Now, he had his flaws, you know, but I didn't know how to take advantage of what he was doing for me.
Right.
You know, anybody in power, they're gonna have flaws.
Right.
You know, but it's, and I say, let's not focus on so much on the flaws, but let's look at the good that the person's bringing. When they make their mistakes, realize that they're human.
Right.
But let's look at the good that they're doing, and that's same thing with myself or anybody.
Right. So I know I was talking to you in the past, and you had mentioned that you was in prison with mobsters such as Sammy Bull and John Gotti. So how was that?
Well, when I got busted in 1990, right? I was 20 years old, so I get locked up. I didn't even know what the feds was.
Okay.
I didn't know what federal and state. Like, I didn't know the difference.
Right. Yeah.
And so I'm talking junk. Me and my co-defendant Boo Bear, God bless the dead. That's my right hand man. But we in there. Right. We talking junk. Oh, just give us a bell. Just give us a bell. Everything they say to us, just give us a bell. I had broke my wrist. I jumped out a window,
mm-hmm.
and I landed. When I landed, I broke my wrist,
mm.
getting away from them. And they was asking me, do I want medical attention? I said, nah, just get me a bell, because I'm getting up out of there. I'll be home. I'll probably be home. I'm saying stuff like, I'll probably be home before you.
Didn't understand what was before you.
And they said, nah, y'all in trouble. This the big boys. I'm like, man, just get me a They told us, this the feds. I'm like, all right, tell the feds, just get us in front of a judge. Get us a bell. We getting out of here. Well, when we went in front of that judge, the bell was $1 million, and they said, "Yes, sir."
$1 million.
Whoa! And they said that you're facing 27 years to life.
Oh my gosh! I would have fainted. I would have been done.
But see, they didn't catch nothing. So I'm like, okay, just give. I'm like, now it's not just give us a bail. I'm like, whoa. So, you know, I mean, so when we get to MCC, that's the MCC Brooklyn. Okay. That was the only, in New York, that was the only federal holding place.
Okay.
Well, they had one upstate New York, Otisville. But we get to MCC Brooklyn, and that's when you know it's real.
Mm.
Guys you see in on 2020, the guy, you know, and guys you see it on the news, and our case, they considered high security.
Right.
So they sent me to the high security floor. Y'all understand what that is?
You
understand?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So they sent me to a high security floor.
Maximum security. Okay.
So I get up there. It's the dorm. The first dorm I went to was where John Gotti was.
Okay.
And that morning, right, I get on, you know, I like, we trained from the streets how to operate in jail. In Brownsville, they teach you how to, I hate to say it, but your friend's conversation, yo, when I was locked up, this and that, the phone.
Right.
That's a show of power, the phone.
Who can control the
phone?
Who
can control the phone?
Right.
So, but it's different in the feds, but I didn't know this. So the first thing I do, I really had to make calls.
Right.
And by now I got the cast on my arm.
Right.
Because now I had to go get medical. So right. I got a cast on my arm. And the first thing I do is go on the phone. I made a mistake. I wasn't on the high security floor yet.
Okay.
First floor they sent me to, I get on the phone, and a Spanish dude, I was on there for like 20 minutes. Spanish dude come up, and he said, yo, that's my time. And I look at him like, yeah, okay, this going to be my example in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes up. This is his phone. I mean, this is his time.
Right.
So I say, cool. So but he left and came back. So when he came back, the girl I'm talking to, I was like, yo, if the phone cut off, no, don't even worry about it. And he came, he's like, yo, and he was aggressive about it. He's like, yo, I told you this is my time. Get off the phone. And he's just walking up. And that back then it was the metal wires that attached to the phone,
right,
the payphone.
Right, right.
And I did catch him with the phone, but the wire made it bounce back.
Mm.
So I caught both of us because when it bounced back, it hit me. It hit me in the head. But anyway, I didn't know that they had tension with the black and Spanish. I didn't know that.
Oh, on the okay. floor.
And he run in the corner, and when I do that, it set it off. So I'm like, I'm wondering why, yo, when dudes, I'm only 100 and maybe 135 pounds.
Wow.
I'm wondering why the dude like backing in the corner like, no. I'm like, man, this easy? I look behind me and like 10 black dudes was behind me like, yeah. So, but he didn't
want, want no smoke.
He didn't want the smoke, but I didn't know something was going on.
Right.
So, you know what I'm saying? But matter of fact, they kicked me off that floor immediately. And they sent me, that's when they sent me to the high security floor where they said, well, you weren't supposed to be on that floor anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I get up there, that's the floor of John Gotti in the morning.
Mm.
And I do the same same thing. That phone. I was a phone right. addict. Phone addiction to the phone.
Right.
I get up there. I do the same thing, and but what they did with me, the dudes was like basically leave him alone. And when the counselor came in, the counselor pulled me in his office. The counselor ended up being a captain. So this dude was a counselor. He ended up being a captain at Coleman.
Right.
When I got there, but he told me, he said, "Yo, we already know who you are. We know your case." He said, "But I got somebody who want to see you."
Mm.
And it was a guy from the other council on the other side of the floor.
Okay.
Was from Brownsville. And he came over and he said, "Yo, we're not going to do this. I'm going to bring you to my floor and you're going to be cool, man." Well, you know, so I was like, but this was so different. I'm like,
right.
Like, I was like really shocked. Like, man,
this can't be federal prison.
Yeah, this can't be.
So they sent me to the other side, and immediately it was like Mike Tyson said this one time. I get there, and there's so many people I know. I'm like, dang. And a lot of that stuff I did was out of fear too. Right. Part of it be fear.
Right.
And the fear factor is like I gotta make my, you know, like, yeah. I gotta establish.
We know that. as correction officers, you know, that you gotta create a stance. You gotta let them. You gotta set the tone and let them know who you are. You know, because yes. You don't want to get tried.
Yes. You explained it exactly what it is.
Right.
You know, so when you see a dude, and now I know in life, when you see a dude talking loud, 90% of the time he just talking.
Right. Absolutely.
But like doing time with Sammy the Bull, like, I mean, before he flipped, mm-hmm. I spent more time on that. That was the floor where I told you the guy, the counsel from Brownsville was.
Right.
So I spent a lot of time on that floor, and meeting Sammy the Bull. I mean, Sammy the Bull, that's the dorm I was brought into. But once he got us, me and my other co-defendant in the dorm, he took a liking to my other co-defendant like a son. Mm-hmm. And, okay, I'm talking Sammy the Bull pre-whatever he did.
Right.
And pre-whatever he did, he was a tough motherfucker. serious.
Right.
He used to train boxers. I didn't, you know, people don't know that. He used to train boxers.
Wow.
So, I met Iran Barkley, Buddy McGirt on visits, mm-hmm. him training boxes.
Okay.
But then, so he used to be like 10 of us, and my co-defendant he took a liking to was total opposite of me. He was like 6'3", 200 something pounds, solid, young dude. Mm-hmm. He was the youngest on our case. He was 18.
Okay.
So strong. Sammy the Bull used to spar. We used to have them punching bag with right. us, but we used to spar with them. He used to spar with 10 of us. Mm. I'm going to say around 10 of us. And dudes knew how to throw their hands yeah. and everything, but he used to spar with 10 of us. Like two, three, that was his workout, sparring with us. And like, I'm talking about, it was just for the body, but right. like, it's things like he was sweating and wet and the bag gloves, and you hit him. You're trying to hit him in his body,
right?
And it slip up and hit him in his chin. I did that a bunch of times, and he'll be like, "I'll stop though, like yo, pardon me." Right. No, don't stop.
That wasn't enough for him, right?
Yeah. So when he did that, when he flipped, it was like, wow. You know, but I mean, like. He used to bring blacks into the dorm. Okay. He had the police, one of the police on lock.
Right.
He used to bring blacks, have blacks sent to his dorm, blacks in Spanish, young right. blacks in Spanish. And one day I asked him like, yo, why are you, cause a black dude came and he asked, did I know him? Mm-hmm. And I was like, nah. I was like, why you always ask that? He was like, nah, I'd rather keep y'all around me because I never did business with y'all. Mm. So if the feds are going to send somebody at me, it's going to be my own.
Right.
I don't want my own around me.
Wow.
When I seen that, I was like, wow. He had a two-man cube.
Right.
And he kept one Italian. That's the only Italian he kept in there was the one he had in that cube. Mm. Every other Italian was in another.
So it's just strategizing how if they came at him, they could only come at him at a way that he can see it before it's coming.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Definitely understand that. So yeah. So you shared with us about Sammy the Bull and what it was like to be in prison, and you know, you having a couple of fights. So how, as far as protection, did you ever see yourself coming out of there in one piece? Did you ever get to the point to where you were just like, man, I cannot do this prison time. It's like, it's too much for me. You know, there's riots going on. How do I get up out of here sooner than what they gave me? So what was that mindset like?
Well, see, when we, like I said, I grew up in prison, you might as well say.
Right.
You know, during the time I did, I grew up in prison. So when I came in there, by the time I got to the, by the time I got out of holdover fighting my case, and the whole time fighting my case, we having fun. Because, I'm going to tell you how, why, because we actually thought that they don't have nothing.
Right.
There's no way we're going to get the time.
Right.
We're going to get time off of this.
Mm.
You know, we wasn't on top of our case. We wasn't doing nothing we were supposed to be doing.
Right.
You know? And once again, we around people from our environment.
Right.
So, but when we got sentenced, when I got sentenced, it got serious, you know?
That's when
it got serious.
It got real serious. Yeah. Like, okay, this is it. Wow. And this is my new reality.
And the effects, and my example of why I got in the game, what got me in the game, is not an excuse.
Mm.
And I don't want the youth to think that it's all right to be in the game. And I'm going to tell you now the effects of my bad, that was a horrible decision. Because there's a whole bunch of other people seeing the same thing, but they didn't do it. You know what I'm saying? Mm. So I just want to get that out the way before people go to glorifying something that's, listen, this was a ugly journey. And the reason it was an ugly journey is not only because of what I did to my life, but because of what I did to my mother, my daughter. Imagine my daughter, she was, I think when I got locked up, she was 18 months.
Mm.
When I, you know, people don't look at this, you know.
How decisions you make will affect your future and people that surround you and love you.
When I got out, she was almost graduating high school.
Wow.
People don't, imagine your, you know, so if you in that game, look at your baby.
Mm.
Every day, and you better kiss her and you know, love her as much as you can, because you don't know the next. I never got to take my daughter to school, to kindergarten, Head Start. I never got that.
Mm.
You know, and people, I mean, so we don't understand what happens with our family, why the black family structure is the way it is. You know what I'm saying? My daughter had to grow up without a father.
Mm.
With a mother, her mother was attracted to what? I was a drug dealer.
Right.
Her mother is attracted to drug dealers. So this is what I subjected my daughter to.
Right.
You know, my mother, I subjected my mother to running up in prisons and visiting me, because I couldn't, like, I got in trouble and got sent to Atlanta. I couldn't tell her, I told her, Ma, don't come see me.
Right.
I think three weeks in,
she's there.
She's there. I couldn't tell her not to come.
Right.
So when that was one of the turning points in my journey.
Right.
Where I seen what I was putting my family through. I get in trouble with something I could have avoided. I get in trouble. They ship me out. They ship me to Atlanta.
Right.
So I had never been to Atlanta free.
Wow.
So, you know, so they shipped me to Atlanta. Mm-hmm. So now that my mother has to pay, I don't know how much money to come to Atlanta.
Mm.
You know, so I mean, and my daughter, like I said, growing up with your father there but not there, that's worse.
Right.
With your father there but not there, and all you could send. I don't care. I used to send money, send whatever I can.
Right.
I used to write letters, you know, and stuff like that. But when I got out, she had a whole different reality.
Right.
You know, I'm thinking, I'm being a father for me. You can't be no, I mean, you could do what you can do.
Mm-hmm.
But what these children need, you cannot be from jail. So you subject your family to the hell you put yourself in, basically. You subject your family to, you know, and I mean, all my brothers, my sisters, all of them went through it with me.
Right.
I got visits from all my family in there, you know, so that, you know, and you know, like, so I had a good support system. Yeah. I know people didn't get no visits.
And you know, Jamal, that's the point where I said I have to get you on the show, because I want you to share your story. People hear it from correction officers, which I am one. You know, we see this every day. This is what we see when I go to work. This is the stories that I'm seeing. This is stories that I'm hearing. I'm seeing the visits that's coming from the parents, that's coming from, you know, maybe the girlfriends or the wives, and the children are always there. So that support system is there. A lot of people don't have that support system. And I feel like without that support system, maybe you wouldn't have turned out the person that you are today. Getting to talk with you, getting to know your story, seeing how you've overcome being in federal prison, being in riots that could have taken you out, just being a ex-drug dealer that, you know, could have been shot up or killed or robbed and killed, or, you know, just any situation. So you have a special story. And so within hearing all of this, like knowing that that support system was there, you're given a second chance, you know, being released after how many years? 16 and a half years of doing hard federal prison time. You know, you going in at what age?
20
years old. So, man, that's you know, you've accomplished so much since that time within hearing your story. Like, how are you becoming an influencer to other people that may have, you know, taken that wrong route and that ended up in prison? Like, what are some of the biggest things that you're doing to help other people adapt now that you're a free man?
Well, the biggest thing you can do is, first thing you got to do, when I got out, the first thing I had to do was get on my feet.
Mm.
And when I got out, you know, like, it was a process.
Right.
You know, like, even your relationships, it was a process. And you just got to be strong. Thank God that my family was down here in Florida, because that eliminated a lot of the temptations.
Mm-hmm.
And guys who go back, right? I when I was in and I see a guy come back, and I'm like, damn, man, I'm the 16 year. I never, you know, I done all this time. I ain't get no chance. And this fool get out and he comes back. But everybody's situation is different.
Right.
You know? And when I got out, I understood, like, it ain't, like, I'm prison is a society within a society.
Right.
So when you're in prison, as long as I was in, you get caught up in that society. And in order for me to cope, I had to cut the world off besides my immediate family. I didn't want to, even with some things with my immediate family, I didn't want to know what was going on.
Mm.
You know, so sometimes when we get caught up in this process now, I went in a boy.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I went in at a young age, so when I came out, I did mature. And I had, you know, like, the biggest thing that made me mature, two things. Dealing with my grandmother dying in there. See, people don't tell you. See, people don't, they don't, these rappers, I mean, I'm not no knock on the rapper, because you only tell them what you're thinking or whatever.
Right.
But they don't tell you this part. I lost my grandmother in jail. Mm-hmm. And when I went to the counselor, I had too much time for to go to the funeral or anything. I went to the counselor. And the counselor say, well, he closed the door, gave me the phone, and my mother was able to tell me, you know, hey, this is what happened. But he came, he told me, yo, you have death in the, he just told me, he said, you have death in the family.
Mm.
We need you to call your mother. Because my mother called the prison to tell. So I went, and she tell me what happened, and I'm, you know, I'm doing my thing, crying or whatever.
Right.
But I went back to the cell. And that night, I think it was a playoff game on. I was always big on sports.
Right.
And, you know, I had a spot in the TV room where, you know, like, so dudes come like, hey, Jimbo, you're not coming down, to watch the game? So I say, nah. So my partner, this dude, now I don't say my partner, but you develop brotherhoods in there.
Absolutely.
So dude, but he seen something was wrong. He closed the door. He's like, yo, what's up? And I said, man, I just lost my grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
He closed the door. I'm thinking he went and watched the game. Before lockdown, they done found a card, and the whole unit signed the card. And, you know, dudes walking by the cell now, yo, man, you know. So it was a little brotherhood, but imagine dealing with that. I had to deal with that. I had to, you know what I'm saying? So how people deal, like the young lady with the sports young lady talking about dealing, I didn't have to deal with that. So I came and I'm not even going to compare that. But just dealing with death, like I had to deal with that in the cell. My right-hand man, my co-defendant, my brother, dude, we was on the streets together. This is my brother. Right. He died in jail.
Wow.
That became a life sentence for him. You know, you never know what tomorrow holds.
Right.
That became a life sentence for him. You know, we was, and the bad part about it, they, under the Bush administration, a law came out that chopped out, I had 27 years, it chopped me down to 17 and a half, or for that, 16 and a half,
right.
You know. So, I'm thinking now, last conversation we had was that right after we got that chopped down, and I'm like, yo, we gonna see each other again on the streets and this and that and this and that. But he didn't make it. This became a life sentence for him.
Right.
You know, he came in the same age I came in. You know what I'm saying? So imagine what he had a family who was supporting him too.
Right. And imagine looking forward to him getting out.
Right. Imagine what his family went through. Right. His son, and my daughter are cousins, first cousins, because we have babies by sisters.
Right.
I know what his son seen him, you know, his son seen him as a ghetto legend, superstar.
Right. Right.
And I talked to his unfortunately, his son got locked up too.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't get a chance to talk about, but that's something that I sent his son a message to the black man.
Okay.
Rich Dad Poor Dad.
Okay.
The Coldest Winter Ever and another financial book. I think Think and Grow Rich.
Okay. By Napoleon Hill.
Right.
And
what I was doing was sending him something to educate him on himself.
Okay.
Rich Dad Poor Dad is a good book to get you to understand investment.
Robert Kiyosaki.
Yeah, Robert Kiyosaki.
Right.
Coldest Winter Ever was, hopefully that was his first book so he could get into reading.
Right.
You know, that, and there's a message in Coldest Winter Ever. That's by a Sister Soldier.
Okay.
Good book. And the Think and Grow Rich was just another financial book. With me, it's about, if you want to change your situation, you have to educate yourself on finance. They don't teach us this in school. You know, so I don't mean college. I don't knock that stuff.
Right.
Education is education. Great. But if you want to get ahead financially, you have to understand. You know, you have to understand the basics, of making your money work for you instead of you working for the money.
Absolutely.
But that's what they
teach you in school, right, and in college.
Teach us in school, right.
Go out, get a good education, get a good job, work hard for your money.
Work hard for your money.
Versus work smart for your money. Allow your money to go out and make you more money.
Right. And I know the mindsets of these kids. These kids are geniuses. We were all geniuses, but we weren't taught. You know, we could, like I said, I watched somebody and was able to put myself in his shoes when I got the chance.
Right.
Nobody had to teach me how to do that. I did that off of watching.
Right.
So if somebody taught me something positive, I know I'd blow up. And my co-defendant's son got out. And this was like gold for me. This is like, he gave me a plate of gold. He got out and he said, man, he called me and he FaceTimed me, and I'm like, who the hell is this?
Right.
He looked so different because he grew a beard. So right. I'm like, who the hell is this? And he's like, yo, this is Yogi, man. That's what we call the nickname. He's like, yo, I'm like, yo, what's up? He's like, yo, man, I wanted to thank you for the books.
Wow.
Yo, and not only did he thank me for the books, but he's told me how he started. He's like, yo, he told me parts of the books that I forgot.
You forgot. You ain't even know.
Yeah, I'm like, wow. But that was like, he gave me a plate of gold, man.
Right.
You know, and that's something I want to start that's something I'm gonna start too. When I get in, that's something I'm gonna start is a book club.
Okay.
For guys about to get, they ain't even gotta be about to get out. I just want a book club because I know when I was in there, this is what got me to, this is what made me read. My mother sent me Coldest Winter Ever.
Mm.
When she sent it to me, my cellmate read it before me. And then I was reading another book, so he passed it on. Man, everybody was coming to me for books.
Mm-hmm.
For that Coldest Winter Ever. Right. I hadn't even read it. I said, let me read this. I read that. That thing was so good. I read it in like 2 days.
Wow.
You know, so I know how books are passed around in there. Right. As a matter of fact, I had a book. I had a bookstore because I used to have people sending me.
In prison?
I had a bookstore.
Wow.
Because people was coming to me for books.
Right.
But then they start damaging your books.
Well, that's when you charge them.
That's when I start charging. So now I start charging them. You know, like, yo, you want to hold it? Okay, give me a pack of cigarettes.
Right.
I didn't smoke, so.
Right. But it was just.
I'm a hustler.
Let me show you, barter and trade within the system.
Let me show you what I did. Pack of cigarettes, right? Eventually, them packs of cigarettes turned into a carton.
Mm-hmm.
When I had enough cartons, I started a store with cigarettes.
Mm.
So that one pack of cigarettes led to, I think, the same thing with magazines.
Right.
You start giving them out. People come back, and of course a page gonna be missing.
Right.
And we had a place we used to order them from because the mom ain't sending me no damn porn magazines.
No porn.
But hold on, we got off a little bit. But basically, coming out, it was a challenge because when I was coming out, I'm expecting the world to accept me with open arms.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a plan.
Right.
But part of my plan, I was the NAACP. I was the president. I started the NAACP chapter in Coleman.
Okay.
So I was, they made me the president. So coming out, I'm actual NAACP president.
Oh, wow.
So, because when we went to one of the NAACP events.
Right.
I sat at the table with the president. The lady was like, no, you sit over here. My godmother, she helped me when I got out.
Okay.
But anyway, you get out and a job. I was supposed to get a job with the NAACP, a paid position, which is over the prison project. But then they said I didn't have a degree or something. So,
Right. Well,
it was red tape. So I was like, all right, cool. I'll get another job.
Right.
Bruh. You know how many no's I got?
I'm sure.
I don't have no job history. I didn't even have ID. I had a prison ID.
Right.
It took me about 2 months to get my ID straight.
Mm.
So I had a lot of obstacles, but thank God I did have a plan.
Right.
I had goals, everything written out. I should have bought that, but I had a plan. Everything written out. And that's from reading them books. They say you got to write your, it starts writing it down. But I had my whole, everything I wanted to do written down. And I looked on, it was just paper because I couldn't see. I'm like, man, how I'm going to do this?
Where do I start it and how do I get started? Yeah.
I'm in the halfway house. I get a job at the bagel factory over there on Mercer Drive,
mm-hmm.
over there behind Mercer Drive. And that was my first job, and my first check was like $200 and something. What I got off of my first check was like $200 and something. And I got to get the halfway house, got to get this. I really wasn't getting nothing. Taxes, I didn't really know about taxes or nothing.
Right.
So I got my first check, and I'm like, damn, I'm looking at this paper, looking at the check,
this don't add up.
Yeah, this ain't adding up. You know, so I just move forward. But then I worked like 3 weeks, and I told the dude, hey, when's my off day?
Mm-hmm.
You don't have an off day.
Wow.
He said it's so nasty. I still had part of the prison mindset.
Right.
I ain't got an off day. I'm gonna make me some off day. I quit.
Right.
I was like, I can't do that.
Yeah.
So one of my plans was to get my CDL.
Okay.
So I'm talking about it was a lot of jobs. And we did at the halfway house. If somebody get a lead to a job that hired felons, we all went.
Right.
So I got a job, and they through the job, I got my CDL. And when I got my CDL, that's when life kind of changed for me. Because now I'm making money.
Right.
You're making decent money.
Right.
And I see where I can make more money.
Right.
You know, eventually get my own truck. That was my plan. That was written in my goals. CDL was like a secondary thing just to get on my feet. And it happened that way, but it didn't happen in the order I thought it would happen.
Right.
And then investment, I was like, man, in 6 months I want to have this amount of houses and this and this and
right,
that.
Right.
And those wasn't, this was stuff I was reading
right.
that I can do. So I had an education, I educated myself, but it's different doing it and doing it in a book.
Right.
You know, so I had to come out, and like I said, opportunities too. I didn't know nobody in right. Orlando. So where if I was in New York, I probably could have filed that paper the way I had it. But now I just didn't happen that way. So, you know, but the struggle, you know, the struggle, I just kept with the course. And my little brotherhood, you know, like one of us get a job, the other put the other on, yo, this job making money.
Right.
And I seen a dude in the club that I was locked up with, and he was at a job that was making a lot more money than we was making.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, yo, he got us on. So, you know, like, but I had to get my CDL. I had to put myself in position to do other things. And there's guys got out, had the same struggle I had. I had a friend that had the same struggle I had. He did long work in prison.
Right.
So he came out, and his fiance financed him some lawn equipment. She said, "What you do it out here?" She said, "Yeah." So he quit the job he was at, got the lawn equipment.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't turn back, you know. And there's so many. I think we have just as many positive stories as we have about people going back. But just like everything else, we're not going to. And this will help the cult, just to help these young guys.
Mm-hmm.
They're not hearing about the wind it up. They're not hearing about that. They're hearing about the negativity.
Yeah.
Can I say one thing before?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I want you to, you know, let us know what you have here and products and
this is my
everything.
Baby's, my daughter's clothing line, Manelli Rose.
Okay.
Manelli Rose. .com. You go go look at her merch, and this is one of her t-shirts.
Okay.
Want to shout out to my family, my mother, my support system, my friends. Hello, I'm off.
I'm right now.
Oh, and I just wanted to say this, right? This is my partner. He, another guy in prison, from prison. That's why he says FCK prison.
Okay.
But he has a clothes, that's his clothing line.
All right.
But I just wanted to say this, that we as blacks, you know, like, first of all, we have to be proud of who we are, and we can't allow anybody to write our history out of, right? They can eliminate our history in schools, but that's not where we're supposed to be learning history anyway. We're supposed to learn our history in the home. We can't allow them to eliminate our heroes, or our people we're supposed to be looking up to.
Right.
I'm not Nation of Islam. I'm a Christian. But there's no way that you have all these posts about Juneteenth and this and that, and you even have what's our vice president name? The sister, Kamala Harris. But you have Kamala Harris' name on your post with a whole bunch of other people, Barack Obama, this and that.
Right.
There's no way Farrakhan is alive and has done so much for us as a people. There's no way that he's not in every one of them posts. There should be no history that's done without his name in it right now, because he is Black history. He is one of the people who didn't stray. He taught us. I learned about Juneteenth, almost 20, 30 years ago, through Farrakhan. So let's not allow, because trust me, they're not going to let us write Trump out of history.
Mm-hmm.
And we witnessed the history he did, and he wasn't good. But they're not going to, when you say Trump, they're going to defend him. You say Farrakhan, matter of fact, blacks have to whisper that they even back Farrakhan if they back him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's not only for Farrakhan, for any of our historians. We got to start teaching our kids about where they came from. That's the disconnect. We don't know where we came from, so we don't know where we're going. That's the, there's a big disconnect. Kids don't feel they could go to the elders, but that's all I wanted to say. That's a whole big.
Yeah, we'll definitely come back again and talk about more subjects that that definitely will put our younger youth in a position where they can win, where they can see, you know, role models that's doing the things that we're doing. You know, you, a successful truck driver, purchased a home, entrepreneur. Myself as well, you know, getting into podcasting, doing a lot of different things. So you have role models within the community that you can look up to, that you can attach yourself to, that you can ask questions and grow within your community, and knowing that, you know, you have a safe house that you can go to someone and get the answers that you need, or you can see role models that are doing something that you possibly want to do. And then you can get some mentorship or some coaching along the way. So that's what we're here for. That's why I wanted Jamal Rose to come on to tell his story, because not only to hear the bad and the ugly part of it, but to see the success story that he has created for himself, right? He had to write his own book. And within a book, you see what he went through. But at the end of the book, that's what matters. From the beginning to the end, you see a significant change and something that he can be proud of, and something that, not only missing the time with his daughter, now he's rebonding and nourishing that relationship with his mom, with his daughter, with that support system that was there. He's letting them know, hey, I didn't forget about what you guys did. I didn't forget about the support that you gave me. Now I'm giving it back. I'm paying it forward. So that's what it's all about. With the Himes Hemp Education Podcast, guys, you never know what you're going to get, right? You never know if it's going to be just education on CBD, hemp, and medical marijuana, or a life-changing story like you just heard from my brother-in-law, Jamal Rose. So are there any last comments that you want to say, or maybe, again, tell them where they can get the T-shirt or the clothing?
ManelliRose.com. I got to get more information on this is Sean, a guy named Sean Hartwell. He started this.
All right.
Yeah, but I got to get more of his information.
Okay. But,
I mean, there's a lot of us doing so much, man. So the same energy we put into the negative, let's put it into supporting black-owned businesses. You know what I'm saying? If you see somebody doing something, especially the T-shirt, you ain't got to change your whole wardrobe if you don't want to, but if you're going to buy, before you buy a Gucci t-shirt, go buy Manelli Rose, or go buy Sean Hall. There's all millions of people selling t-shirts, you know. Let's keep whatever, but I'm saying that for whatever. And I'm not saying don't buy from no other people. You know what I'm saying? That's it can be done, but that's ludicrous right now. But let's start by buying one thing. Let's start by buying one thing that you use, black owned. Let's start there.
All right. With that being said, guys, thanks for listening in. Catching another episode of Himes Hemp Education Podcast, where you can follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. Guys, go follow us. Put in the comments, hey, I watched your episode. It was great. Let us know what you think about it. And then, you know, also maybe give us some tips on something else that you would like to hear about. But with that being said, guys, we'll see you on the next episode. Peace.
Peace.
Thanks for tuning in. Go follow MelHimes3Media.com, IG, Himes Hemp Podcast, and all other social media platforms.